You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
I am very thankful that Melissa Baldoff is willing to come in here once a week and talk about climate issues. It's a subject near and dear to her heart, but she wears many hats as a consultant, as a political strategist, and more. And so we're probably going to spend more time in this segment on a couple of other matters, and then we'll get to a little bit of our climate check and the happy cows that can result from a little bit of creativity when it comes to solar farms that are out there. But Melissa is going to help us first deal with the new budget deal right after we talk about the breaking news of the state Supreme Court throwing out the 1849 law that some had considered to be an abortion ban. Melissa, good morning. What's your take on the state Supreme Court throwing that 1849 law out, kicking it to the curb?
Good morning. It is a good morning. And, you know, this is exactly what, you know, I think so many people wanted to see happen was a fair and impartial court invalidating a law that, you know, is almost 200 years old and really impacted the rights of women to make our own healthcare decisions. So this is, you know, this is a law that predates us even, you know, just knowing about germs, right? I mean, this is ridiculous that this has been on the books for so long. And it is just an incredible win for the people of this state to have women's rights and freedoms restored by this court.
Well, and on top of that, for all this talk about, you know, originalism and what founders intended and all that, you know, why would we take away from the notion that we have had continuously changing government, continuously changing society for these past 150, 200 years? And what the progressive justices were saying was, look, there have been all of these other changes to abortion law over the years, so many different changes that it basically can't help but overrule the stuff that was written earlier, because again, elections have consequences. You have different people in charge each time. They've made these changes of law. Looking at this, and I have skimmed it as quickly as I could, and I have to say, this AI summary that Tony has helped put together and shared with us is, I think, pretty good. It says the court erased the state's near total criminal abortion ban as a matter of statutory construction, not constitutional law. Abortions may resume within the detailed and sometimes onerous regulatory framework enacted since the 1970s. They note that the legislature retains full authority to tighten or loosen that framework, and the ruling invites renewed legislative deliberation rather than ending the debate. And again, Melissa, it's just a matter of, you know, again, we, with all the respect you can have for your founders, they don't get to tie our hands. We still get to live in the here and now, whether you're talking about muskets versus assault weapons or women's role in society and the rights they have now versus then.
Exactly. You know, this is one of those perfect illustrations of why the, you know, Constitution is a living document. It was always intended to adapt and change with the times, and the framers could ever have conceived of the society we have now. I think if you took, you know, the framers and dropped them in today's society, you know, their heads might explode when they saw, you know, all of the technology we have and where we've come, you know, and that's just the whole point, is that it was always intended to be a document that was changed, was adapted. The only thing that isn't supposed to change is, you know, the core principles and beliefs of, you know, life, liberty, and justice for all. That's the foundation, not, you know, any other specific prescriptive words necessarily, because those can change and should change and have changed. And the abortion law here is, you know, a great example. It's, you know, kind of like the, you know, ship of Theseus, right? And that's, I think, where we've gotten with this, the end of this case, right, is like where it started, it's changed so much. Is it even that thing that it started as anymore? And it's really not. You know, it's changed so many times what the law is on abortion and what the ruling is. So, you know, I think that this is a great day for women, to make their own healthcare decisions again, even though we know that there are limits there. But, you know, protect things like IVF, which would have been completely at risk here. And make sure that, you know, women and families have the right to make their own decisions about what's best for them.
Yeah. The folks that want to start their own theocracy can do it, you know, someplace else. Because right here, every election matters. And yes, we live in a time where the next election is always the most important election. The one that switched control of this state Supreme Court was the most important election of its time. Prior to that, the re-election of Governor Tony Evers was the most important election of its time, which takes us to our next subject, the new state budget deal. Governor Evers worked it out with Republicans who control the legislature. It will be a very bipartisan vote later today in the Assembly and the Senate, with Democrats voting yes and no, Republicans voting yes and no, and people having very strong feelings on depending on what end of the spectrum they're coming from. And I'm not saying all that to say that this is a good deal, Melissa. But again, if Tony Evers had not won election, you know, the way this would look under a Governor Tim Michaels administration is a hell of a lot different.
It absolutely is. And, you know, this isn't the budget that the governor wanted. The budget the governor wanted is the one he proposed. But this is, I think, this is a very good deal considering what the alternative was. And this, I think, shows the incredible commitment of the governor and his staff. I want to make sure to really shout out my former colleagues in the governor's office and throughout state government for their work on this, because, yes, it is the leaders and the principals, making a lot of these deals. But it's also an incredible, incredible amount of work by the staff to get there. And their commitment to this is just unparalleled. But I applaud the governor and our Democratic leader for getting there, because this is, I do believe, the best deal we could get out of this legislature. But at the same time, I respect and value and support the Democrats who are going to vote against this, because it's not what we deserve, and it's not the best budget for the state. It's the best budget we could get right now. But it's the best budget but it's not the best budget for the state. So, you know, I think that they are correct to, hold the line for themselves and for their constituents, and to draw the contrast of, you know, what is going to be in the state budget and what could be and should be in the state budget. And they'll really have a chance to demonstrate that when Democrats are in the majority in, you know, a couple years here with the budget. That's the goal. That's what we think is going to happen. Democrats taking back the Senate and an incredibly good chance to take back the Assembly. And the budget that will pass in 2 years because of that is going to look a whole lot different than this one. And it's going to be a whole lot better for the people of this state. So I think this was, you know, the right choice, even though it's a very difficult one. But Governor Evers has proven time and time again that he is willing to make the difficult choices that need to happen.
We're talking to Melissa Baldoff, and we've covered the legislative matters, the court matters. Now let's get to something that really matters: happy cows. And
I've got to just say, I still take a lot of issue with the whole marketing campaign of happy cows come from California.
Oh, yeah.
From years past. Bull. I mean, it's
that's
just
bull offensive. Pun intended, by the way. So, yeah, that's, we know where the happy cows are. And
that's right.
And they're up here. The story actually comes out of Morris, Minnesota, University of Minnesota campus out there. But for all of the caterwauling about solar farms that says, well, the crops won't be able to grow now and cattle won't be able to graze now. I was always a little dubious of that, because like anything else, you know, you pick your shot. You use what is best for the land if you can. But if you can use a little creativity, then so much the better. And the story out of Minnesota is all about how a solar array, a whole bunch of solar panels, are put on top of basically an electric powered vehicle, a tractor, a truck, whatever the case may be, that slowly moves along the field so that the cows can graze in the shade underneath the panels. I don't know if I have a particular climate question here. I'm just here to salute good old American ingenuity for getting the best of both worlds.
Yeah, this is such a cool story. I loved when you sent me this. I mean, talk about innovation. And like you said, using what you have. So this is, I think, just incredible to see the fact that, you know, we know that we have seen so many farmers and producers and folks in the ag industry be incredibly committed to climate solutions. And it is just great to see that, you know, you can do both things, right? Two things can be true at the same time, as my husband Joseph Hecky likes to say quite often. And that is that we can do right by the planet and continue doing business in a way that is going to be productive and beneficial. So, you know, I think this is a great example of that. And I hope to see, you know, more, I hope to see some farms in Wisconsin employing this approach, because it seems really neat.
I've never been able to ask Melissa a personal question like this, but she has opened up the door for it. Tell me that Joseph Hecky has used that saying during discussions between the two of you to say, well, two things can be true at once. I didn't do the dishes and I was very busy today.
No. So he definitely uses it in personal conversation with mm-hmm. me and with the kids, but not to get out of his share of
the
household chores.
All right. The solar trailer, by the way, has a capacity of 60 kilowatt hours. The panels are equivalent to about 18 kilowatt hours. It obviously does not have a long extension cord, you know, that's tied to the grid. So you're powering these batteries that can then be used, you know, later on down the road. But again, it's just another way of saying that invention never stops. When I was there was a special legislative committee on biofuels, and there were a lot of people going, oh, ethanol is terrible for the plant, blah, blah, blah. But the research that's being done on biodiesel all across Wisconsin, and so that you need less of a carbon footprint, you know, to grow the corn or the different crops that make biofuels. I was just amazed by it. People wanted this knee-jerk reaction to oppose ethanol. Look at the research and watch how it's evolving and unfolding. And that frankly, given where the Trump administration is, I think that's where we're going to get, you know, the positive stories, is the ongoing role of innovation.
I agree. And that I'm going to use that to tie back to very briefly, and I'll make a point here, I promise, our conversation on the budget. And one of the reasons I think that the budget deal is the right one is because of the investment that is coming into our university system with mm-hmm. this budget. When Republicans initially wanted to do nothing, and now we're going to get a big investment for the UW system. And, that's, you know, right. This story we see is in partnership, the project, with one of the University of Minnesota campuses.
Yep.
And the campus is carbon neutral now, thanks to their advancements in energy production. So perfect. We want to make sure that we can keep innovating on our campuses as well. That's very important to our progress.
Melissa Baldoff with our climate check and much more. Thanks, Melissa. Have a great 4th.
Thanks, you too.
All right, a local update is next for some of you, and the rest of you will come back here for some final news and notes and a visit with James Kelly. Remember, you can follow me at upnorthnewswi.com and, of course, right here mornings on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll have State Representative Angela Stroud on Republicans supporting lead water line removal in Superior if They can stick taxpayers with the bill instead of a private utility. We'll also have our climate check with Melissa Baldoff. You're going to love this one. I think Hans should come back for this one. Solar panels in farm fields. Oh, you heard us talk about this with John and Gordy yesterday. Solar panels in farm fields on electric powered tractors so that the cows can stay under the shade of the panel as it slowly rotates through the field where they're grazing. That's in Climate Check tomorrow with Melissa Baldoff. We will also have our weekly visits with our civic media friends Earl Ingram in southeast Wisconsin, James Kelly in northwest Wisconsin, Jimmy Cuska in southwest Wisconsin, and, of course, Parker and I will have Melissa Kay in Wisconsin Rapids with the latest on her
Pigeon Quest.
I just wanted to see if Parker was standing by with the Pigeon Quest button, and he was.
I've always got Pigeon Quest ready.
That's so good. Dan Hagen joins us from Newswatch 12 in Rhinelander. Hans Breitenmoser, Lincoln County dairy farmer from the Merrill area. Gentlemen, how are you?
Doing great.
All right.
Good morning, Pat. Good morning, Dan.
Hans, how about you? I know the official crop report said there was 3.5 days of field work available last week because of the rain. Obviously, a lot less in some parts. How are things up by you?
Well, pretty wet. Now, we've had a couple of dry days here, and we're actually going to start chopping our second crop this morning here in the next few hours. So,
yeah, the second crop got chopped here in the field across the street from me yesterday. And I've already marveled previously at, you know, just how big and how fast, you know, this equipment is getting. I swear that thing was moving at least 30, maybe 35 miles an hour down the field. And I, you know, you think of baling hay and you think of just very slowly working your way down, chopping, and not this stuff. Boy, we got like something out of Transformers working the fields out here. And Dan, you're following stories up in Rhinelander, not the least of which are some in Hans's Lincoln County. And, you know, there's a nursing home there we've talked about that may or may not be for sale. But then in Taylor County, not too far away, there's also some kind of drilling project going on over there. What's the latest out of Taylor County?
Yeah, that's right. So Greenlight Metals is this Canadian company, and they are on the Toronto Stock Exchange. They have a subsidiary based in Wisconsin, and they have started drilling in Taylor County at what's called the Bend Deposit. That's near Medford. And there is a lot of gold and copper at that deposit. The issue that is, however, it's using like non-ferrous metallic mining. And more or less, this releases a ton of sulfuric acid. So there's a reason why there is a moratorium on this kind of mining for a long time. That moratorium has been lifted. So this kind of exploratory drilling is the first step toward opening a mine.
Potentially so. And it was a mining moratorium that Tom Tiffany was very instrumental in lifting and exposing this area to all of those harms from, you know, that exact kind of drilling. And not just creating a mine, but I mean, just the experimental drilling itself has potential to cause harm to the groundwater. So it's why people are concerned even about the test drilling that's going on right there. And Dan, of course, is following that out of Rhinelander. Hans, I know you're following things with the Pinecrest Nursing Home sale. We were talking about the county board maybe putting it up for sale. This is not yet a done deal?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it ain't over till it's over. The county board here in Lincoln County sold the nursing home once before, and then that deal fell through. After the fact, the county board voted again in favor to sell here to a different company more recently, and that vote went through as a simple majority vote. Now, some people are saying that there should have been a two-thirds vote to make that happen, since it happened outside the regular budget process. But the people in Lincoln County are just concerned about losing our nursing home and losing control of our nursing home. When we ran it ourselves, or when we partnered with North Central Healthcare to run the operations there, we at least had some control over it. My argument against selling it, one of them, is that, you know, once it's sold, we simply lose all control. And the company that has purchased it now, you know, they've got about 340 of these facilities all over the United States. And my argument was, look, you know, even if the people who own this company now are, you know, super, and you know, they're going to treat residents well and treat employees well and so forth and so on. I said, this is big business. And, you know, there's no guarantees. I mean, we could see a different ownership, you know, have the thing bought out by a different company in a couple years from now and have the wheels really fall off. So it's confusing to me as to why the county board is choosing to try and sell a nursing home that's a five-star facility that's been doing great financially the last couple of years. It's taking care of our residents and keeping the promise that we've you know, had, the deal that we've had for 70 years in Lincoln County is if you work hard and you do the right thing, we'll have a place for you when you get old.
So I can see why Dan and everybody at Newswatch 12 is following a story like this, Dan. It's got real human impact. Again, that whole notion of, you know, the benevolent corporation that will always be benevolent, or will it be? I'm sure, Dan, you get reaction every time you do a story about this issue.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I just want to ask you one thing, Hans. You know, you said it's doing well financially, but, you know, we keep hearing that it's losing the county $1 million+ every year. So what do you mean by it's doing good financially?
Well, it's been self-sustaining for the last, year and a half, 2 years. When I was on the county board years ago, it was, you know, there was tax levy dollars that needed to keep it afloat. There's no doubt about that. And we partnered with North Central to help, you know, improve efficiencies and so forth. North Central Healthcare is a consortium Lincoln County works with already. And so it seemed like a good fit. And you know, things turned around. It took a little while, but things turned around. But what I find interesting too, Dan, is that, you know, when through a survey that was done in Lincoln County, when people were asked, would you be willing to help support the nursing home if need be? The resounding answer was yes. So people in Lincoln County are looking at their nursing home and saying, yeah, even if it costs us a couple bucks, we're willing to keep this thing afloat because we see it as important. And we understand that, you know, if we no longer have control over it, we might not have a nursing home at all. And what does that mean for us in, you know, in terms of, you know, when you're elderly parents or what have you have to go to a nursing home, do you want to place them 2 hours from your house? You know, what does that look like? We've got an ideal situation here, but what we also have, I think, is a majority of county board supervisors who came into their role as county board supervisors with sort of this hell-bent philosophical notion that if you know, government shouldn't be involved in anything. And they've been unwilling to look past that and look at the facts here on the ground with our particular situation and see that we've got something special here that we should be hanging on to. And in doing so, you know, we create the economy that goes along with it. You know, we can, you know, there's 200 people roughly that work at Pinecrest Nursing Home. If Mega Corporation Incorporated decides that you know, these dots on their little balance sheets and spreadsheets aren't working out very well from their perch on Wall Street, and they say, yeah, it's time to pull the pin and Merrill, 200 people lose their jobs, and we don't have anything to say about it. To me, it's just poor management.
And Pat, you can cut me off if you'd like, but I think the argument from the other side, I heard from Ken Wickham, a county board chair, is, you know, this has been an issue for a long time. A lot of these county board members were up for re-election. They got re-elected, even though their stance on Pinecrest was clear. So what would you make of that argument that they were elected, they can make decisions for the people?
Well, I mean, I agree with that to a point. And I'm not, you know, having been on the county board for 10 years, I don't think that, the board should rush to referendum for every 98 cent detail. Yes, you have to put your big boy pants on and make some decisions for your constituents. But one of the things with Pinecrest is it's such a big deal. It's such a big deal in our community. And so many people, ask so often, just put it to a referendum, you know, so we can get the input from, you know, from the people that are impacted from it. And the board refused to take it to a referendum. I think if they would have gone to a referendum, they would have found out that, you know, people want this thing and they're willing to support it. And they want to keep it alive. So I agree with what Ken said. Yes, there was an election. But there's also plenty of evidence to suggest that this is something that people wanted more input on.
You often hear that when it appears that the elected officials, you know, are acting more on their own ideological behalf than on, you know, the will of the majority of their constituents. But again, you know, they're the ones that have to make the decision whether to have that referendum or not. So obviously Dan's got a lot to follow, and I'm glad you were here to ask some questions of Hans about that. Dan, here's a question or a comment for you on the text line from Jim in Brookfield. Hey, Dan, sounds like a true case of Berkey fever to be roller skiing in July. Good luck reaching the magic number of 20 Berkeys for the purple bib. Again, from Jim in Northfield, because Dan mentioned he's going to go roller skiing after this segment.
Well, I appreciate that, Jim. I will tell you, my father is a birch legger, as it's called. That means 20 Berkeys. He's done about 27. I will be on my 11th or 12th. And, you know, you got to keep staying active. I just was notified I got dropped a wave. I've been in wave two for a year, but my time was too slow, so I got bumped down to wave three. The goal is to get back up, so putting in the work now.
That's why you lift those weights now. You know, got to be ready for it.
That's right.
Dan Hagen, you can follow what he's doing over at Newswatch 12 and Rhinelander. The man's got to get his roller skis on. Thanks for sticking around a little bit longer, Dan. We appreciate it.
Of course. Good to see you, Pat. Good to see you, Hans.
All right. Take care now.
Yeah.
Hans, I wanted to take a moment with you to talk about the president's trade war, which is still ongoing, even though we don't talk about it quite so much. But specifically this, from the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, has told the Wall Street Journal the Trump administration may consider granting tariff exemptions for goods that are difficult to produce domestically in the United States, like cocoa beans or coffee. Currently, these products are subject to comprehensive tariffs, which have led Democrats to criticize Republicans for driving up consumer costs. In an interview, Rollins says, "Everything is still under discussion at this stage. I believe that for certain products we cannot produce domestically, it's important to fully understand the situation and develop a comprehensive strategy that supports all of these goals." Do you feel congratulations are in place and in order for the Trump White House for discovering the 1920s era song, "Yes, We Have No Bananas"? That we cannot grow bananas or cocoa beans or coffee here in the U.S., so why put on a tariff designed to bring products back here when they were never here in the first place? I think it's great that it only took them 5.5 months to figure this out.
Yeah. So, I mean, that just gives me an abundance of hope, Pat, because if 5.5 months is all that took, then I can hardly wait to see what the next 5.5 months will bring.
Again, it was supposed to be 90 deals in 90 days with 90 nations out there.
I think what we've seen is 90 changes of minds and 90 flips and flops and 5 months of chaos, leaving our trade partners confused, leaving our farmers confused, leaving the Farm Service Agency confused, leaving the markets confused.
Yep. And again, like we had one farmer from Chippewa County saying, you know, is it America first or America alone? And it's tough to tell sometimes. Hans Breitenmoser, thank you for your time as well. Get out in that field. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Ben.
All right. We'll continue things on here with a local update for some of you. Others will be back here. And then in our next hour, Dan Schaefer and Chad Holmes, all across the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Seven 7:35 now on these mornings, powered by Up North News on the Civic Media Radio Network. On the text line, Tom in Hartford, another great guest, Pat. It's uplifting to hear an intelligent, caring representative. Ain't it, though? It's just nice and refreshing when you get that compared to some of the things that you see out there in the news cycle. This is going to be a big day in Madison, not just because the legislature's meeting on the budget, but the Wisconsin Supreme Court has announced that today it will release its decision on its interpretation of an 1849 statute that some had purported to be an abortion ban. Others interpreted it as doing something else about protecting pregnant women. The law has been on hold since a Dane County judge ruled, I believe in the fall of 2023, that the law did not apply to consensual abortions. It was appealed to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case last November and is now ready to issue its ruling. And so that will come sometime today. So keep it tuned to your favorite shows across the Civic Media Radio Network to learn more. Let's turn now to a matter in our schools about participation in sports and other activities, and especially as it relates to members of the transgender community, that we're going to meet with a guest from the Baraboo area who is a retired pediatric nurse, sits on the school board, but is going to join us in a private capacity, and wrote a letter to the WIAA expressing concerns about a policy that restricts transgender student athletes to participate only in the sports categories corresponding to their sex assigned at birth. So let's learn more about that and what perhaps might be a better way forward with Carolyn Bonanno, who joins us now from Baraboo. Carolyn, good morning. Thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm good. It's frustrating, but good.
It does sound frustrating. You note in your letter to the members of the board of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Activities Association that their policy fails to account for current scientific understanding and may not serve the best interests of all student athletes. And you say this as a retired registered pediatric nurse and somebody who has certainly followed school matters carefully on school boards. So can you talk a bit more about, you know, what prompted the letter and then, you know, basically your overview of the policies that prompted the letter?
Because I am on a board and I learned about this, and I had been hearing rumblings, and I always heard that, well, this isn't true, that they shouldn't, it's not scientifically sound. And so I decided to do some of my own research because facts seem to be able to speak louder than feelings, and I think it's important. So I looked it up and I tried to find things that said that transgender women had an ability over other female athletes, and there was very little evidence to that at all. And as my brother said to me the other day, this whole thing, it just seems to be a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. And I think that it puts our most vulnerable students at higher risk. And so I just felt it was so wrong. And it's kind of like the first steps to dictatorship. This happened immediately after Trump wrote his letter, his executive order banning transgender females, and this only and WIAA's policy only refers to transgender females. It doesn't look at anything else. I don't think they did any research whatsoever. They just followed along. They were in lockstep.
Yeah, it does have very much the sense of just a bit of political backlash, if you will, to things like legalizing same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. Then there's another, let's find a new category of people to bash. You write that current research indicates that athletic performance differences are more complex than a simple binary categorization of assigned sex at birth, and that athletic performance varies enormously among individuals within any gender category. And that really gets to one of the things that has really stuck with me, is this ridiculous sense that somebody, a minor or an adult, would go through what you need to go through just to win a race? I mean, I thought it was silly on its face, but I mean, like you said, you had to look into the fact based of it to say between individual variations and simple binary categorization, there's a lot more to this than the surface talking points.
Yes, and it kind of boggles the mind as to why people would think that this is true. I mean, one of my first experiences as a school board member, I've only been on for about a little over a year, was sitting down on a summer learning symposium at a table with a gentleman who was trying to push his facts through and saying things, we can't have these big guys competing against women. And I just looked at him and said, I don't think that's true. And I ended up leaving the table, and at WASB, the Wisconsin Association of School Board, has always, I mean, this person has been trying to put through policies to change it on a school board level, and WSB has declined, and we as school board members have declined this. So it boggles my mind that WIAA can have this much power. It bothers me. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I mean, there's still a lot to learn about these kind of things, and at best it should be an individual categorization. I mean,
right. And they are not the only body that is working with this issue. And you note that the International Olympic Committee and other sports bodies have recognized that it's not about transition per se, but the timing of it, particularly where it occurs, you know, in terms of puberty. And certainly we're talking about things like testosterone levels, not simply the fact that there's been a transition or treatment, but again, time, testosterone, a whole lot of other factors that the International Olympic Committee is trying to be cognizant of. And you're concerned that the WIAA is being a little too simplistic about this, I think.
It very. And their policy was just very simplistic. There was no whys or wherefores about it. It was just a very simple statement saying this is the way it is. And I don't think they gave it any thought whatsoever. And it just seems punitive to me and dictatorial. So, like I said, I did the research. The timing is important. And the thing is we don't know what's going on in anybody's mind or head or physical things. And it is something that you need to consider personally. I think they're pandering toward the fears of other people who don't have an understanding of what's going on. And frankly, why do we care? I mean, it's really small numbers. And it's really important.
Really small. and it just, again, it provides opportunity for talking points, but also, as you note, privacy violations. The current policy, you write, forces families to engage in legal proceedings to secure their children's right to participate, which inherently compromises student privacy. It exposes personal medical information and gender identity status in public legal proceedings, violating the fundamental privacy that all students deserve. Or, to put it a bit more crassly, but it certainly has been, so I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said before, the fact that some people want to do this is going to mean that a whole lot of other kids are going to be traumatized by either a coach, a school official, a lawyer, somebody. They're going to want to look down a kid's pants. What the heck is this?
When I was meeting with some legislators in aid, said that to me, that somebody, a representative, said that, well, just check them. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I mean, and as my daughter says to me, she says, Mom, it's weird that these people care so much about children's privates.
Yes.
It's weird.
It is weird. And it hasn't been said nearly enough, but it just is. So let's try to look forward on this. And we're talking to Carolyn Bonanno from Baraboo about this letter she wrote to the WIAA. And you asked the board to consider several things. You write, for example, developing individualized assessment protocols that consider factors such as hormone therapy duration, individual athletic metrics, consulting with medical professionals, sports scientists, LGBTQ+ advocacy groups, and review policies from other states and organizations that have developed more nuanced approaches. I think that's the key word there, is nuanced or individualized or consulting. All of these things sound like best practices moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the world of medicine is, best practices. It is evidence-based. And that should be how everything is. Things should be based on evidence, on what is least destructive or hurtful to other people, and if it's even a necessary thing. You have to look at these things. You don't just willy-nilly. This is how dictatorships happen. Yeah. People just fall in line, and nobody says anything. So yeah. I felt it was important to say something.
And so you urge them to refocus the WIAA's mission on supporting and including all student athletes rather than operating as a restrictive enforcement body, return to the core educational mission of fostering student development through athletics rather than creating barriers that force families to choose between their children's privacy and their right to participate in school activities. So that was the note. The letter was dated May 22nd. Has there been any response or reaction since then?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing. I emailed the members individually, and I sent this letter, and I have not heard a thing back.
And it sounds like there's no current plans to reconsider or do anything else on the issue?
Nope.
On the comment sections here from CT, the ban on transgendered student athletes buys into the notion that women are inherently weaker than men, which is ridiculous. And Alicia notes that policies like this do way more harm than good. And I mean, none of this strikes me as so unwieldy that you can't consider a better path forward.
Exactly. But I think that because of the current political ish system, we have somebody who thinks that he can just tell people what to do without any backlash. And whether you have it or not, he will just do what he wants. And it seems like the WIAA just fell in line. And well, unfortunately, and it's bothersome to me. I'm sorry. It's bothersome to me because I thought that the school boards were supposed to give guidance to the WIAA, and it doesn't seem to be that way. It seems to be the other way around.
Well, it does. And when you talk about one individual, it certainly is about more than just, say, you know, who is president. Mm-hmm. You have, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who has held up millions and millions of dollars in UW funding to attack diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think, again, I'm projecting, but I wouldn't be surprised if WIAA board members were mindful of that and didn't want the Speaker of the Assembly threatening to cut off funds for high school sports and, you know, being focused on state budgets and school district budgets instead of the welfare of our kids is a hell of a way to run the state.
Exactly. And it seems to be backwards in my estimation, but
well, it certainly does, and that's why I really appreciated your willingness to come on and talk about the note that you sent. I hope you keep us updated, Carolyn Bonanno, as far as whether you get any kind of a response and any possible path forward. Carolyn, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. A local update is coming up next for some of you, and then in our next hour, we will be talking to Earl Ingram about things happening in the Milwaukee area. We will also have Jimmy Koska coming up next for some of you, talking about what he's seen from Southwest Wisconsin, and then an hour later, James Kelly from Northwest Wisconsin, doing the same thing as we do here, mornings, powered by Up North News, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Did you know that Civic Media app has a brand new feature on it? You can use it to text us, of course. We've talked about that at length. But you can send us a voice note as well. You just use that voice note feature, and you can record a little audio message. It might be a comment on something you're hearing. It might be a question for one of us. So just all the more reason to download that Civic Media app and use the voice note feature to stay in touch. Tomorrow on the program, Hans Breitenmoser will be here, dairy farmer from up in the Merrill area, Chad Holmes from Wausau, Dan Hagen from Newswatch 12 in Rhinelander, and Dan Schaefer from the recombobulation area. And then on Wednesday, State Representative Angela Stroud from up north. But right now, we're going to have a little conversation with Jeff Mandel from Law Forward and talk about what I don't know, you can either call it billionaire bribery or you can call it bribery adjacent campaigning or whatever it is. Jeff Mandel and Law Forward want to make sure that these kinds of practices stay on the up and up or don't happen at all. Jeff, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
No, it's nice to have you here. Thank you so much. Let's put it in your words instead of mine. Tell us about the lawsuit and the genesis of it and the outcome you hope to get.
Thanks, Pat. The lawsuit is about making sure we continue to have free and fair elections here in Wisconsin, and about perpetuating a series of actions that Law Forward has taken to hold accountable those bad actors who try to undermine free and fair elections in Wisconsin. So let's step back to March, to the home stretch of the Supreme Court election that we had here in Wisconsin this past spring, to remind your listeners what happened. In the last 12 days of that election, Elon Musk, the world's richest man, showed up in Wisconsin and started to offer cash incentives for people to vote here in Wisconsin. And first, it was a petition that offered $100 to any registered voter who would sign the petition that very, very closely echoed the campaign themes and messaging of one of the candidates. And then all of a sudden, it was the chance of million-dollar checks to people who had signed the petition and said they'd already voted in the election. And then there was a series of payouts as well in the weekend before the election for people who were knocking on doors and getting photos of voters with the holding campaign material for Musk's preferred candidate and giving a thumbs up or a smile. All of these are efforts to induce people to vote. And in Wisconsin, you cannot give anything that is valued more than $1 to try to induce people to vote. It's against the law.
It sure seemed pretty clear that way. I mean, you can't induce anyone to go to the polls, to vote for or to vote at all, or to vote for a particular person. You refer to it as a brazen scheme to induce Wisconsinites to vote. And I think that's a generous way to put it. I mean, brazen truly fits what he was trying to get away with.
It's really outrageous. And it's even more outrageous when you put it in the context of some of the things we've seen in Wisconsin over the last few years, including complaints filed by individual candidates or political parties when, say, on campus, there was a Get Out the Vote activity that offered ice cream for people who came out to early vote. And they said, well, ice cream is worth more than a dollar. Maybe it is. I mean, I don't know exactly what the details of that program were, but $1 million check is certainly worth more than a dollar. And even the chance to get $1 million check, right? We don't sell lottery tickets in this country for less than a dollar usually. So it really is a brazen scheme. It's brazen in how open and outrageous it is, how contemptuous of the law it is. And we can't let this continue. The day after the election, there was a really distressing article to me in the Washington Post because U.S. Senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, who I guess made his own news this past weekend, but Senator Tillis was asked about this, and his reaction was really just astonishing to me. But what he said in essence was that Elon Musk is a disruptor. And he comes in with new ideas and thinks about things differently than we have before, and we all have to adapt. And so what he said is, for the 2026 midterm elections, we should expect to see millionaires of all different political stripes standing up on stages and giving away huge checks. And that's just a horrifying dystopian vision to me. That's not the way we understand or want elections to work in this country. And that was really one of the moments when we decided we had to, even after the election, come in and try to make sure this can't happen again.
Right. I mean, because I mean, you either have that outlook or hear me out here. You don't allow voters to be bribed in one form or another. But now we have to ask the legal thicket question that there was an effort just prior to the election to try to get this practice smacked down, and courts did not go along with it. What is different this time now that the election's in the past? What is different about the lawsuit, the arguments that you're making that you hope make it more likely a court will formally and finally end practices like these?
It's a great question. I think really the biggest difference is the context and the timing. You know, courts have a tremendous amount of power, but they also, as institutions, are not really built to work quickly. Excuse me. The goal of courts is to arrive at the truth and then to enforce the law based on what it finds about those facts. What you were referencing, Pat, was that in the run-up to the election, there was an effort by Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call to put a stop to an event the Sunday evening before the election where Musk handed out two $1 million checks. We had been pushing Attorney General Call to take action and to try to stop this, and we're grateful that he made the effort. But he filed his papers on a Friday afternoon, asking the court to stop something that was happening 48 hours later. And that's really just not in sort of the DNA of our court system to do things quickly over the weekend in exceptional circumstances. The wheels of justice generally grind slowly, and the courts, no court that weekend. Within those 48 hours, Attorney General Call was in the trial court in Wisconsin, in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But none of those courts said that he was wrong. None of those courts said that what Musk was doing was okay. What each of those courts said is, we're not willing or able to do this on the schedule you're asking us for. And so what our lawsuit is doing is saying, okay, we'll take you at your word, courts, but now the election is over. Things are calm and settled. We're not in an urgent situation, but we do need to know what the law is and get this clear before the next Wisconsin Supreme Court election, because we can't allow this to happen again. And if you remember at the beginning when I recapped what happened, I said that Musk didn't start these efforts until 12 days before the election. I don't think that's accidental. I think part of what they're trying to do is jam the courts. They're trying to show up and do things right on the edge and do them at such a time that nobody can really stop it. And so we're coming in at this moment and saying, let's put a stop to this.
It's downright diabolical. We're talking to Jeff Mandel from Law Forward. It's a legal group that already has a pretty good history of holding some bad actors to account. There was the exposing of the fraudulent electors scheme that was cooked up here in the state. And then there was the complaint against the Office of Lawyer Regulation that held that former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman had made some ethical abuses during his sham investigation into the 2020 election. So, you know, this is a group that does not take things lightly when you're doing these things. So you have filed the lawsuit here against Elon Musk. What's next? How should we expect to see things play out?
Well, as I said, courts move slowly. And so there's going to be a period of time where the defendants here, which is Elon Musk, a political action committee that he founded and runs called America PAC, and then another organization that he created with the unbelievable name of the United States of America, Inc. They're the ones who sent people these actual checks. So you would sign the petition from America PAC, and it said that America PAC would send you a check. But the check actually came from the United States of America, Inc. People got emails that said the United States of America has money for you. So those are the defendants here, those three entities. They're going to have an opportunity to answer this complaint, and then the lawsuit will get rolling. So I would expect around Labor Day, we'll have a schedule from the court and we'll be able to move forward.
Can somebody also then do the lawsuit that says, what state allowed you to incorporate the name United States of America Incorporated? I mean, I don't know who runs these anymore. I always thought it was every Secretary of State's office in the state, but somebody dropped the ball on that one.
Indeed, Pat, you are correct. I mean, I think we all share an intuition that it just doesn't seem like it can possibly be acceptable to incorporate and claim that you're doing business in the name of the United States of America. You'll be unsurprised to know that the answer to your question of where was that ball dropped is in the Texas Secretary of State's office.
No.
And, you know, we could either go to court in Texas and try to deal with it there, or what we didn't want to do was make an issue of that and allow the whole case to get sucked into the federal courts. This is really an issue of Wisconsin law, and we want this resolved here in our Wisconsin courts.
Oh, okay. There's just so many issues. I mean, I could even go off on a different tangent. I remember when Ron Johnson first ran for office, and this was, 2010, and instead of paid for by Ron Johnson for Senate, it was paid for by Johnson for Senate LLC. And I'm like, what kind of path are we wandering down here that corporations are literally running for office now? But that's a side issue. And then one other side issue, forgive me for going off on a tangent here, but when we talk about signing these quote-unquote petitions, and I want to put finger quotes around petition, because I remember when I was running for Congress in 2012, and they said, oh, we got to do these petition things. And I still have a very old-school definition of what a petition is. You know, it's to list your grievances against the government, for example. But that's not what these are. These are campaign things. They just collect your name and say, hey, we collected 110,000 signatures on this petition. It's not an actual petition, but it shows the slippery slope of first a petition is not a petition, and now a petition is something that maybe we could send you a dollar or $1 million if you sign. And it is so hard as a voter to know what's a gimmick and what's not a gimmick, that the worst thing that could happen, Jeff, is that you and Law Forward aren't there to at least try to get a court to provide a little bit of clarity of what some bad actors can't do.
Well, it is very frustrating because, as you say, we think of petitions as a means of aggregating public opinion and giving it to decision makers to help guide them and help them understand what their constituents want. But these days, so often, especially online, petitions are not that. They are simply means to collect people's email addresses and text numbers. And it's just a whole shift in campaigning, as you mentioned. And some of it is constitutionally protected, but actually paying people in an effort to induce them to vote or to induce them to vote for a specific candidate, that is illegal. And yeah. We cannot allow ourselves to go down that road here in Wisconsin. No.
Cannot. Jeff Mandel from Law Forward, thank you so much. I really appreciate the information and wish you all the best in the suit.
Thank you so much.
All right. Local update is next for some of you. For others, you'll come back here for some final news and notes from Lake Wissota. I'm Pat Kreitlow on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.